They're skipping rope all the way to the Olympics. Some young people decide jumping rope is not just for kids and take to a stage out here in Pasadena. Thousands of people in 40 countries want to turn the playground activity into an international event. Serious play. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, May 9th. From serious play to just plain serious, today Lebanon's in crisis after officials crack down on Hezbollah, a conversation with a superdelegate who's struggling to make up his mind, and in Hollywood it's a mad dash to keep actors off the picket lines. Right now, more headlines from Femi Okeh.
The United Nations is suspending aid shipments to Myanmar after the government began seizing the supplies. As international aid officials continue to complain about the lack of access to Myanmar, Myanmar State Television reports on the meetings its prime minister is having about the humanitarian crisis. This is how Myanmar State Television covered the meeting earlier today.
The prime minister urged officials concerned to cooperate and participate in rendering assistance for our own people who are suffering painfully.
And that was an announcer for Myanmar State Television. International aid officials say that less than 10% of Burmese are currently getting aid relief. For the first time since the collapse of the Soviet Union 17 years ago, heavy weaponry rolled through Red Square in Moscow. The BBC's Richard Galpin reports.
Military jeeps and armoured personnel carriers led the way. Tanks and rocket launchers followed. The true purpose of this year's parade is to tell Russians that their country is regaining some of its former strength and tell the world that Russia wants to be taken seriously again.
The parade marks Victory Day, which honours the 9 million Red Army soldiers who died in the Second World War. A democratic plan to put thousands of struggling homeowners into cheaper government-backed mortgages is being derided as a bailout by Republicans. The plan cleared the House yesterday. President Bush is threatening a veto if it makes it past the Senate. Several reported tornadoes moved through the southeast late yesterday, wreaking havoc in North Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, and Tennessee. Outside Greensboro, North Carolina, the strong winds killed one person, injured three others, and damaged numerous buildings. Oil prices hit another record today, rising above $125 a barrel in Asian markets. And on Wall Street, the markets get off to a slightly more positive note. The Dow gained 52 points, the S&P closed slightly up 5 points, and the Nasdaq added 12 points. Just coming up to 4 minutes past the hour. Over to you, John.
Thank you, Femi. We're a bi-coastal show this morning. I'm in the studios of KPCC in Pasadena, and we have a question for all of you in light of the New York Times lead editorial, which suggests that maybe Hillary Clinton should get out of the Democratic race. How do you bail out? What would you do to bail out of something you really, really committed to, like a relationship or you know, who knows?
A job.
What would you do? A job.
Or a line at Starbucks. We just want to hear your story of how you got out. Brad tells us, first, I love you, love your show. What have I done to get out? Manage expectations and position yourself as a victor loyal to your constituents. We want to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
More violence in Beirut today. Barricades have gone up in the city separating the Sunni and Shia areas. The machine gun fire could be heard in most areas of the capital, according to witnesses. It's a power struggle. The BBC and PRI's Aaron Schachter, who reports for The World, is there. Aaron, what's happening today?
Hi, Adora. How are you? It's interesting that you guys started off with this question of how do you back down, because that's the big question here. How do these different forces back down from the fight that they're in? And it seems like the only answer here would be for one of them to win. And it seems perhaps that the Shia group, Hezbollah, and its other organization, Amal, may be close to doing that. They've taken over the television and radio stations of the leading government group, the Sunni organization, the Future Movement, and as well as taken over the homes and businesses of many of the ruling party's members of parliament. From what I can tell, there are people, colleagues of mine, are spaced out around the city. They say that gunfire is down a little bit. They're not sure whether that is a result of one side taking charge over the other, or whether it's a lull in fighting.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this violence contained to Beirut? Has it spread across the country? And what exactly triggered it in the first place?
It has spread across the country to places where the two religious groups, in this case Sunni and Shia, are sort of historically at odds. And all along the road from Beirut to Damascus, there is sporadic fighting, as well as roadblocks put up by one group or another. We just got word that in the north, roads have been blocked as well, and as well as roads leading down to the south. There has, of course, been a standoff here for a year and a half, a little more than a year and a half, between the opposition, which is led by Hezbollah, but includes another Shia group, as well as a major Christian party, against the ruling coalition, which is Sunni and does include Christians as well. The main problem was really kicked off at the beginning of the week when the governing coalition held a cabinet meeting and said that they were going to dismantle Hezbollah's cell phone network, as mm-hmm. well as demote the head of security at the airport. They accused him of letting Hezbollah set up surveillance systems over one of the runways.
So
Hezbollah took odds with that, and both sides made threats, and then they made good on their threats.
And so what is the government doing? What is the police able to do? What are do you have a sense of what the plan is potentially to deal with this?
There seems to be no plan at the moment. There is simply no way that the government can physically take charge of the situation. There's going to have to be some kind of negotiated settlement. And as I said, at this moment, it seems like Hezbollah and the opposition forces have won or are in the process of winning. They're well-trained fighters. They were in a war in 2006 against Israel, and they are, by all accounts, constantly training in camps in the mountains and the Bekaa Valley, which is on the way to Syria.
Mm-hmm.
The odd thing, and you may see this from television pictures, is that the army is deployed all over the city. You see them in riot gear, in armored personnel carriers. It looks like a really substantial force, and it is in some ways, but the problem is that they're in a position in this country, much like the UN in Rwanda or something. There are no good guys and bad guys. The only thing that the army can do is keep two sides apart.
Right.
As soon as the army fires on one group or another, they are in essence taking sides.
The BBC and PRI's Aaron Schachter. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Adora.
So, John, you've spent a lot of time in Lebanon. What do you think about these latest developments?
Well, it's fascinating that the dismantling of a cell phone network, fires this off. You know, we're used to thinking of Sunni-Shia tensions in Iraq, but the demographic changes in Lebanon have created much more tension in that part of the world, and it's fueled by Syria and Iran. So not surprising that this would happen.
No, you are. It is interesting that it would be the cell phone network, but essentially that just shows how tense the situation is. But we're going to come back to news here in the United States, and that is, of course, the race for the Democratic nomination for president.
Are you the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party?
Not yet. I will be if Senator Clinton decides not to go on, or if we complete these six contests and we are ahead as we are now.
That was Senator Barack Obama yesterday in an interview with NBC's Brian Williams. Most pundits, as I'm sure you've heard them, now seem to think that the race for the Democratic presidential nomination is over. But is it? Senator Clinton is still on the campaign trail, just like Senator Obama. Yesterday, he was in Washington, D.C., lobbying hard for the votes of the 200-odd superdelegates who now seem to hold the future of the race in their hand. So what's an undecided superdelegate to do? David Hart is among them. David?
Yes.
Are you getting lots of phone calls and emails and visits?
Absolutely.
Okay, how many phone calls yesterday?
Actually, you know, I stopped answering my phone, to be honest, because I can't handle the number of calls and still be able to function during the day.
Really?
Absolutely. But I get hundreds of emails a day, hundreds of letters coming to my home address a day, and it's, you know, I did an CBS interview yesterday, and they asked me just to bring a stack of the handwritten letters that I get.
Handwritten from the candidates?
Not from the candidates, just random people from around the country that support one candidate or the other.
Oh, people that you don't know and not, say, members of your immediate community?
Right.
Oh, interesting. And what are they saying to you?
You know, to be honest, handwritten letters, the letters that are coming to my home address, are almost entirely in support of Hillary Clinton, you know, sometimes begging me to make the right decision, to support a candidate that's more electable, that can beat John McCain, that looks out for the working class Americans. And I think the reason why I get more letters from Senator Clinton supporters is they're traditionally a little bit older and still write letters.
Okay, what's the best letter you've gotten so far? I just want to note also that you are the president of Young Democrats, so you're really involved
right.
in the political process. But what's the best pitch you've heard so far, and what's taken you so long to make up your mind, or have you made up your mind?
No, not yet. The best letter I actually got was a group of letters from a women's organization that had letters collected from all over the country. And they went state by state doing their own study, breaking down the electability of each candidate versus a Republican opponent. And it was very in-depth, very insightful, and I thought it was just extremely interesting that here's a group of random citizens that would take the time to write this long letter, group them together from different people all over the country, and really do an in-depth study of what the electability is of each candidate.
And which kind of begs the question, David, and please forgive me for being a pest. I mean, this campaign has gone on so long. I mean, what more information do you need to make up your mind? Will you please tell me?
Well, you know, there's only a few states left. I personally think that we should let the remaining states vote. There are 7 million people that still have yet to vote. And for me, there are hundreds of thousands of young people that still have yet to vote, and I think that as a representative of the Young Democrats, that this is really exciting. While it is a little bit of bruising right now, it's still a family fight, and we will come together at the end, but give states like Oregon a chance to build their voter files and to use this election as a way to get the excitement going and collect the data that they need to win elections. Not only for the White House, but for
now.
That's
fine. I don't understand how that affects you making up your mind. I understand why Oregon would need to weigh in here.
It sounds like a good argument for democracy. David Hart, uncommitted superdelegate in Dallas, Texas. We wish you all the best luck, and we hope you don't get drowned in all those letters today.
Make up your mind.
But here's a bigger question that we're asking today. Yeah. What's the best way you ever have gotten out of anything? A job or a relationship or whatever? Traffic. We want to hear your story. 877-8 MyTake. MyTake at thetakeaway.org. John, you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, we'll be back.
I turn off my mic. That's how I get out.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8 MyTake.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. So how do you back down? That's the question on The Takeaway. Think about it and call 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll have your responses later in the hour. But we're going to step away for a moment from the news we're following in Lebanon and in the political campaign. I'm out here at Southern California Public Radio at the studios of KPCC, and I spent all day yesterday at the Serious Play Conference at the Art Center College and Design in Pasadena. And it was serious, and it was very playful, Adora, and it was actually quite fun. And one of the places that was focused on at the conference is a place where a lot of people do some very serious playing. It's Second Life. You know about Second Life.
We've actually talked about Second Life. It's fascinating, actually.
Yeah, there's 10 million people who have avatars and identities in the virtual world of Second Life. And on any given day, 250,000 people are in there buying and selling things, talking to each other, showing off, interacting, doing any number of things. And it's all a virtual computer-generated world.
That's extraordinary. 10 million people.
Yeah, it's big. But still, Philip Rosedale, who's the Linden Lab chief executive and the co-creator of Second Life, who we ran into at the conference and actually presented at the conference, says there are still two types of people in the world. There are people who look at Second Life and go, this is fantastic. Where have you been all my life? And then other people who go, this is creepy. I don't want any part of it. We've actually talked about this, and Philip Rosedale had this response to the two types of people in the world regarding Second Life.
Yeah, people are still just either, you're absolutely right, they're either baffled by the question of why one would create such an unstructured thing, or they're just totally along for the ride and get it from the moment they see it. And it's a challenge trying to get people to just get why it is that creating a virtual world is innately appealing.
Some of the people who do get it are people like, for instance, one of the most interesting communities founded in Second Life very early on was stroke victims who use Second Life as a place to interact with reality in a way that socially would be very upsetting for them, particularly recent stroke victims, because they don't necessarily want to go out, but Second Life allows them to go out and have a social life.
Yeah, there's just no question but that we can use computers and interfaces and technology to create a space between us, a space that we can enter into that is more facile relative to what we want to do day to day than the one we're in now. And that is just an incredible thing because it means we're going to move a lot of our intellectual and almost physical activity into there and not look back.
This week, Grand Theft Auto, it was announced, grossed $500 million in, I think, its first week of sales, which is a record for video games. It's probably a record for almost any kind of media. It certainly dwarfs what the movie industry has been able to do recently.
Does it
give you any satisfaction to hear that much of the evaluation of Grand Theft Auto doesn't so much talk about the game, the winning, the losing, the behaviors that you can do in the game, which are mostly pretty unappealing, but it talks about the levels of reality, the fact that there's like a TV network in there, that there's a cell phone network in there, there's a virtual internet network in there. Does that make you feel pretty good?
Absolutely. You know, there's this certain magic that happens when a space, when a simulated space has enough generality to be magical to us. I heard a story just the other day about Grand Theft Auto 4. It was a friend of mine told me that a friend of his who was playing it, loving it, actually just decided to follow someone that had a virtual person, and a virtual person, not another player, that had come out of a store with groceries to see where would this person go? You know, and he said the person walked down the street, walked down another street, walked and walked and walked, and eventually got to a park, and then turned around and retraced their steps back to the store because they were a sort of an automaton, you know, that was creating this background. And he said that the friend sort of said that the magic kind of cracked at that point for him, you know, that when he saw the person reach the park and come back, he knew that it wasn't real. But that of course, it seemed so unbelievably real that he was entranced and didn't even want to play the game, just wanted to, like, follow these little details.
Second Life has certainly generated some headlines in the financial transactions that have taken place in there, some of the sort of sexual mores that sort of bounce around inside Second Life. How do you answer the criticism that an uncritical view of something like Second Life encourages people to kind of parachute out of the plane in terms of reality and maybe indulge in some dark sides?
Well, you know, I think that people will do things. I do think that people certainly learn from all the environments they're in, and habits can certainly be taken from one medium to another. However, the question one has to ask about sitting in front of a computer versus walking around the real world and interacting with real people is, I think the most important question is one of, is what you're doing more or less complicated? Is it teaching you things that are going to be convertible to the real world? Now, in Second Life, you're confronted by an environment in which 65% or so of the people using it are not from the United States. If you, for example, are from the United States, it's a very international environment. It's about balanced between men and women nowadays. You're confronted with an economy, a micro transaction economy that's incredibly rich and sophisticated, and everybody's making things and selling things. In short, I think of Second Life as a kind of almost a lemonade stand, in the sense that we want to have our kids make lemonade stands, where you are trying to experiment at being successful in a world that is more complicated, typically, and more diverse than the world you're actually in. And that learning, it's very hard for me to imagine that that's not a beneficial learning for most people relative to what they take away from it and go back to the real world. Now, does it allow you to indulge fantasies or jump off buildings or do things that would be dangerous or lethal to you or others in the real world? Well, yes, but it also, as a side effect, has you re-examining everything around you, I think, at a level of freedom and generality and clarity that you don't get out of real life. And I think that the pros outweigh the cons relative to its impact on people.
Sitting down with me yesterday in Pasadena, that was Philip Rosedale, Linden Lab chief executive and founder of Second Life. And now more headlines from Femi Okay.
It's 28 minutes past the hour, and fighting in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, continues for a third day between pro-government groups and supporters of the opposition group Hezbollah. At least 8 people have been reported of being wounded. In other international headlines, Iraqi police commandos say that they have captured the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. However, the U.S. military says they have not captured Abu Ayyub al-Masri. North Korea handed over more than 18,000 pages of nuclear weapon documents to a U.S. diplomat to help verify its plutonium holdings. Officials say the documents are another step towards the goal of getting a full declaration of North Korea's nuclear activities. And finally, climbers can now get back onto Mount Everest, where the Olympic torches ascent temporarily held up the climbing. Hundreds of climbers were boxed in at base camp since May the 1st. They were waiting for the flame to reach the top. Now it has. They can carry on up the mountain. That's a look at your news headlines from around the world and the U.S.
That was a tough trip, I think, that the torch took up Mount Everest.
The torch needs to get out of the way.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
So from one virtual world to another, Hollywood is dealing with some impending reality out here. The Screen Actors Guild and the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists have begun wrangling over contracts with the studios, raising fears of a strike and heightened inter-union strife between SAG and AFTRA, which is a really big deal for the movie industry out here and for television. I should say I'm a member of AFTRA, just to disclose that up front. Anyway, the studios are worried about a potential strike when the actors' contract ends on June 30th. They're speeding up timelines on shows and films already in production with the writer's strike. We've heard it all before. Nikki Fink, blogger of Nikki Fink's Deadline Hollywood Daily, joins us from Los Angeles. Is it sort of deja vu all over again, Nikki?
Yes, very much so, especially in the way that the studios and networks are negotiating with the Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA. It's almost a repeat of the WGA and Directors Guild negotiations.
Is this about the same issue, the revenue stream from new media, or is there something else at stake here?
Well, there's always, depending on the guild, separate issues. In fact, one of the issues that the actors are wrangling with are clips of the actors' work, 5-minute TV clips, 10-minute film clips. The producers, a.k.a. the moguls, I love the way they call themselves the producers. Even the producers guild said, you know, they're not producers, believe us, they're owners. The conglomerates want to use these clips for free, in other words, not pay the actors anymore, and also not get consent anymore.
So, and this would be like YouTube, podcast sorts of things, and you know, forms online that are yet to even be created.
Or it could be whole movies that they create out of clips or TV specials and not have to pay the actors at all.
All right, so what's the sort of hard out here in terms of actual production? What's threatened here if this doesn't get resolved over the next couple weeks?
Look, I don't think anybody necessarily has the stomach for another strike. But what there is right now is a de facto strike in Hollywood, especially when it comes to movies, because no mogul in his right mind would greenlight a movie between now and really July until this gets resolved.
Do you know a lot of moguls, Nikki? Do you know a lot of moguls, actual moguls?
Of course.
You do? Okay, great. Well, that's good. I just wanted to make sure that. So no one's going to greenlight anything. Are there celebrities and actors who are on the other side who are likely to increase their profile and argue for the studios to concede?
Well, that remains to be seen. I mean, SAG and AFTRA have been at each other's throats over this because AFTRA is primarily a television union. It doesn't represent any movies, and it represents just a handful of scripted series. I mean, SAG is the prestigious, sorry, I know you belong to AFTRA, Actors Union. It's the big one. It's basically what really protects actors. AFTRA's contracts are usually much worse. And what you have right now is, you know, a lot of the actors haven't gotten involved yet. You've had a couple of the triple A-list actors trying to put pressure on SAG to get to the table and solve this as soon as possible. Well, they did that, except the moguls basically ordered the AMPTP to just basically sit there on their hands and not.
All right, that's an acronym alert. What's the AMPTP? And then we got to go.
That is the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, which basically is the clique that represents the Hollywood CEOs.
Right. Nikki Fink is a blogger for Deadline Hollywood Daily. Thank you for joining us. It's a standoff. More later. We're in suspense on the SAG studio dispute right now.
And talking about tough relationships, Hillary Clinton's presidential ambitions, well, many say they're not looking so good. But if she does decide to get out of the race, let's say before the voters go to the polls in the last six contests, how would she do that? On The Takeaway this morning, we've been asking you for your best get-out stories. How did you get out of a job? How did you get out of a relationship? And for that, for some advice, rather, we're going to turn to Lynn Harris, who blogs at breakupgirl.net. Lynn, what are the rules for getting out?
Well, normally I'd say that it's tacky to hold a press conference. But I think in Hillary Clinton's case, it might be okay.
Why would that?
If that's what it comes to.
So just a press conference? Should she write a note? Should she
put a message on the internet?
I mean, how should she do it?
She's going to be able to take us all out for a nice dinner. But I think, excuse me, I think at this point, where we're at is the point in a relationship where, you know, we're in couples therapy. Everyone wants it to work out. But we're at the point in couples therapy where we're trying everything we're doing. We've gone through all of our issues, and we just want to stay in there long enough to make sure that we really mean it when we leave.
So, of course, we're speaking metaphorically, right? I mean, you're yes. comparing Hillary Clinton's relationship with her voters and with America. You said one of the tricks is to be dignified and graceful. What actions make up dignity and grace?
Well, I think what I've read now, and this is to sort of abandon metaphor for a minute, what I've read now is that she is now moving away from attacking Obama and simply showing her own determination against what seem to be mounting odds. And I think that is one way to maintain dignity rather than attacking her opponent. I mean, look, going back to the metaphor, this is really kind of a mutual breakup if you think about it. I mean, really, we as Americans, we've met someone else.
Lynn Harris, co-creator of BreakupGirl.net. So what do you think, John?
Dear America, I've met somebody else. He's a really tall guy from Illinois. I really, really think he's special.
But isn't
That's the breakup.
But isn't it kind of America chose the other guy? Or voters chose the other guy? Anyhow, we need some more headlines. Right now, we have Femi Okeh for that.
And it's 21 minutes to the hour. Making news this hour, presidential nominee Barack Obama has picked up more support from some superdelegates. Oregon Representative Peter DeFazio has endorsed Obama. New Jersey Representative Donald Payne is switching his vote from Clinton to the Illinois senator. A UN official says Myanmar's junta has seized all the food and equipment that the World Food Programme had flown into the country for cyclone victims. The official says the agency has, and I quote, no choice but to suspend further aid shipments to the devastated Southeast Asian nation until the matter is resolved. The worldwide manhunt for a suspected pedophile has ended in New Jersey. Interpol's Ronald Noble said that tips from people responding to their bulletin helped track down Wayne Corliss in Union City.
We received approximately 640 leads within the first 24 hours. From those leads, we're able to identify the stage name of the person who has now been arrested, a photograph, and his bio.
Corliss is suspected of sexually abusing young boys in Southeast Asia. And finally, just an update on oil prices. They surged past $125 a barrel as the weakening U.S. dollar drives investors to snap up commodities.
Wow.
$125 a barrel.
It's also interesting, the superdelegates, maybe they're starting to turn. That's interesting, Femi. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. It's Friday, and of course, that means movies are opening today, and Lynn Harris is still with us. And of course, because as a public service, you know, presenting the movie information is very, very important to us. We like to give you something that you can get nowhere else. The movies that are being released, among the movies being released this week, are Speed Racer, Surfwise, and What Happens in Vegas. And instead of just playing trailers from those movies, we have for you the official Takeaway Mother of All Trailers.
In 1956, after years of insomnia, after years of anxiety, I embarked upon an odyssey.
Vegas!
Here's the one place where you can step up and be a man.
San Francisco. Baja.
Florida. Venezuela.
Mexico. Alabama. El Paso.
20th Century Fox and Regency Enterprises present.
For 10 years, I was either pregnant or breastfeeding without one day off.
Well, I'm going to need a divorce.
Absolutely.
A comedy about two people.
Your parents said you can go to school because it's safe. Our parents said
the only way you'll ever stop these people is to bring them to justice.
I love that. The mother of all trailers there. And the first movie we're going to talk about, of course, is the blockbuster coming out this week, Speed Racer. It's Warner Brothers' glossy adaptation of the cartoon series. It's got lots of flash. It's got some story. And it's got the directors, the Wachowski brothers from The Matrix and V for Vendetta. Hmm. The reviewers are hating this. The question for Lynn and for Adora and for all of you out there is this movie art or is it escape? Lynn?
I'm going to go escape in the sense that I would like to drive Speed Racer as fast as possible away from this movie.
It could be just fun.
I already feel a little car sick, I got to tell you.
It could be a little fun. Next up, we have What Happens in Vegas, and this is a wild, drunken night in Sin City. Apparently leads to Cameron Diaz and Ashton Kutcher getting married. And then their plans for divorce, well, it gets a little sticky when they hit the jackpot in a casino. And you can imagine the hilarity that might ensue from that. So
hijinks.
Hijinks. Yes. Is that art or escape?
I'm feeling escape pretty strongly.
That's a gamble. I think that at this point, if you're getting your storylines from Britney Spears' actual life, it's not going to wind up that funny.
Yeah, and yes. The critics weren't too high on this either. They're saying there's no big surprises, but they do say that Ashton Kutcher and Cameron Diaz are very appealing, have a lot of chemistry on.
I would like to think so. I did see the trailer for that one, though, and it was really just they spent a lot of time throwing things at each other, which I'm not sure is using their talents to their utmost.
More of a screensaver rather than perhaps a movie.
Yeah.
Rob
yeah.
Corddry from The Daily Show, or formerly from The Daily Show, is in that movie.
That's a ray of hope.
Exactly. All right, Doug Prey directed Surfwise. It's a documentary relaying the personal history of Dr. Dorian Doc Paskowitz. He's an 85-year-old surfer, health advocate, and sex guru, okay? And they have 9 children, okay, he and his wife.
Wow.
What would you say, escape or art there? Documentary is the clue.
Yeah, well, it's got to be art. And I think it also will make a lot of us actually feel like better parents. So that's an element of escape for us, too.
Okay,
better
Lynn.
By comparison.
Lynn Harris.
Thanks, Lynn.
BreakupGirl.net. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, we'll be back.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, May 9th, and we have headlines for you from Femi Okeh. Femi?
Good morning to you as well. Making news at 12 minutes to the hour, we have more violence in Lebanon, where sectarian clashes have erupted around the country. At least 8 people are reported to have been wounded in the fighting. The World Food Programme has halted aid shipments to Myanmar, also known as Burma, after the contents of its first delivery were impounded on arrival. The aid was flown in to help victims of Cyclone Nargis. Presidential nominee Barack Obama has picked up some more support from superdelegates, with New Jersey Representative David Payne switching his vote from Clinton to the Illinois senator. And Oregon Representative Peter DeFazio has also endorsed Obama. The U.S. House has passed a House rescue bill aimed to stabilize the housing market. President Bush has promised a veto, though, saying it's a bailout for lenders and also for speculators. Now, some people seek out local seasonal foods, but the British celebrity chef Gordon Ramsay has called for restaurants to be fined if they serve out-of-season products.
Chefs should be fined if they haven't got ingredients in season on their menu. I don't want to see asparagus on in the middle of December. I don't want to see strawberries from Kenya in the middle of March. I want to see it homegrown.
The ever controversial Gordon Ramsay, and he didn't do any of that with an expletive deletive. That's your news.
Huh. Femi, thank you. Fining for not serving strawberries. Interesting. Well, in Israel, they're celebrating the country's 60th birthday, but yesterday the festivities were interrupted by a corruption scandal. There'd been some rumors for some time about Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. He has been accused of taking hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes from an American businessman. Olmert admitted yesterday that he took cash during his campaign but denied any wrongdoing. Opponents are calling for the prime minister to resign after this corruption charge, which is the 5th in recent years. The allegations come just days before President Bush visits to help negotiate an Israeli-Palestinian peace settlement. From the New York Times, the bureau chief, Ethan Brauner, how complicated is this for Omar?
Oh, hello, Adora. I would say it is very complicated for him. I would say that, he was already quite weakened, was not a very popular prime minister since the second Lebanon War almost 2 years ago. And there has been sort of a long-standing sense that whatever he was going to do in the peace process was a bit of a Hail Mary to keep himself in power, and that that might, in fact, push the peace process forward. Now, I think Palestinian negotiators and those around him and generally people in Israel suspect that all we're looking at is a political decline without any real authority going forward.
And how does this affect Bush's upcoming visit, the tone of it, the agenda of it, the effectiveness of it?
Tone, I think, will be affected quite profoundly. Officially, I don't think the agenda will be. I think that the president has stated that he's planning to come and meet with Prime Minister Olmert. It seems extremely unlikely that Olmert's future will be decided before or during that visit. It's only days away. So I think that everyone will be going through the steps in a relatively staged affair. It seems hard to believe that much can happen in Palestinian peace as a result of what's surrounding Prime Minister Olmert with this scandal. Now, to be fair, it didn't look too good before anyway. The peace process has not been in great shape.
Now, have these pronouncements and these accusations, have they overshadowed the celebrating of the 60th birthday of Israel?
Well, yes, they have. I mean, the actual public announcement of the investigation and the prime minister's press conference occurred very late Thursday night in Israel at the end of the Independence Day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that so that during the course of the Independence Day, it's true that the prime minister is kind of under a shadow a little bit, and in his various official capacities, people were watching him to see how he was handling himself. But I would say most of Israel did, in fact, take some satisfaction, some deep satisfaction in the 60th birthday of the state, all that has been accomplished by this state. It's always a bittersweet kind of place and mood in Israel because of the sense of security concerns and great political disputes. And I think all that what it meant is that the chattering classes had something more specific to chatter about yesterday.
Ethan Brauner, New York Times bureau chief in Jerusalem. Thank you.
My pleasure.
John?
So, Adora, before we go, I wanted to give you a sense of this Serious Play conference that I'm at out here at the Pasadena, California, at the Art Center College of Design. It began with this fellow, Stuart Brown, who you may have seen in the New York Times Magazine a couple of weeks back. He's the founder of the National Institute for Play. And he says, despite what maybe you and I were taught when we were younger, that play, instead of being something we do in our spare time, is actually essential to every aspect of our development, physiological, cognitive, everything. This is what he said on stage yesterday, and it was really exciting to listen to.
Play has a biological place, just like sleep and dreams do. And if you look at sleep and dreams, biologically, animals sleep and dream, and they rehearse, and they do some other things that help memory and that are a very, very important part of sleep and dreams. The next step of evolution in mammals and creatures with divinely superfluous neurons will be to play. And the fact that the polar bear and husky, or a magpie and a bear, or you and I and our dogs can cross over and have that experience sets play aside as something separate. And it's hugely important in learning and crafting the brain. So it's not just something you do in your spare time.
So when you play with your dogs, you're working on your brain, Adora.
I'm glad to know that, actually, John. That's just one more that's just another added value to having dogs.
Well, then Robert Lang showed up. Now, he's a mathematician. Have you ever folded paper like origami? You know what origami is?
I sure do.
Now, the rules of origami are you have to make a creature or an animal or a form out of a single square that can't be cut, and it has to be folded just, you can't cut it and you can't twist it or anything. It just has to be folded. Robert Lang has turned origami into a science that has had all kinds of impacts on medicine and the construction of airbags. And his mathematics in playing with origami forms has produced real life-saving developments. And he talked about some of those on stage.
the applications came from unexpected places. So in this application, that heart stent, that came from the water bomb, the blow-up box that many of you learned. It uses the same crease pattern. And the airbag algorithm, that came from the design algorithm to create deer and lobsters and other things. This happens not just in play, but all the time in math and science, that things that you pursue because they're fun turn out to have practical interest. And so for airbags, heart stents, this sort of thing can be not only fun, but it might even save a life, which is pretty cool.
Robert Lang, I should point out, is an awesome celebrity in Japan, where he's done things with origami that no one has ever done. He's made lobsters and bugs and cuckoo clocks in origami. It's really, really interesting. And finally, of course, you know, with all these like pointy heads on stage at Dora, we had to have some real playing. And so here's some of that.
And I know there's a lot of people that probably want to beat me right now. But, of course, my job is to beat myself. I'm my greatest competitor right now.
That's an excerpt from the movie Jump. Those jump ropers that we featured at the beginning of the show want to make jump roping an Olympic event. And last night they rocked the house here in Pasadena.
Huh. Interesting. Well, it sounds like you've met some fascinating people, had some fascinating conversations. But right now I want to remind you about something. Can you take a listen to this, John?
Sure.
Eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He's
Do you know what that is?
Yes, well, that's a Battle Hymn of the Republic, of course.
And why do you think I'm playing it right now?
You know, I have no idea. It's Dionne Warwick, I think, right?
It is Dionne Warwick. The bottom line is Sunday is Mother's Day, and some people have this notion that somehow it's some kind of Hallmark-created celebration, and it's really not. The first American Mother's Day was celebrated in Grafton, West Virginia on May 10th, 1908. Now, that's exactly 100 years ago from tomorrow, and it was inspired by the British version of the day and was imported by social activist Julia Ward Howe after the Civil War. They wanted to have a day where they were acknowledging moms.
Huh. That's great. You know, I missed my mother's birthday last week, so I really have to catch up this week and call mom probably as soon as the show's over.
Yeah, I think you might want to do that.
I better do that, yeah.
Because your mother is a lovely woman. I've met her.
And yours is a lovely person and a force of nature.
My mother is indeed a force of nature. She's going to like that you said that.
Happy Mother's Day, moms.
Happy Mother's Day to all those moms out there. Our takeaway question, what's the best way you ever got out of anything? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And we hope
And thanks to KPCC here in Pasadena and Chee Pearlman at Sirius Play.
Have a great weekend.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.